It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz.
What up, John? It's Guy. Ready for your interview? LOL.
Okay. This is John McWhorter.
I am writing to Guy, and I'm saying, Guy, I'm in the booth.
He's a linguist.
Slash.
And he has a kind of a radical theory on...
See, slash is a thing.
Texting.
Drinking Jamba Juice.
L-O-L. Let's do this interview.
Lol, let's do this interview via text. Lol. Oh, lol, R-O-F-L, laughing my...
It would take us, like, forever to do this by text.
It would.
We could not do... This would take... We would have to book the studio for, like, 3 hours.
You know, even though this is basically speaking with the fingers, nobody ever said that it was this fast.
Okay, so he snuck it in there, but that is basically John McWhorter's big idea, that texting is more like speaking than writing. And that makes it almost like a new form of language. Which brings us to today's show. Language, spoken and unspoken. How it started, how it's changing, and how words might not be the most important part of it. But first, what could texting mean for the future of human communication? Here's John McWhorter's TED Talk.
Basically, if we think about language, language has existed for perhaps 150,000 years, at least 80,000 years. And what it arose as is speech. People talked. That's what we're probably genetically specified for. That's how we use language most. Writing is something that came along much later. If humanity had existed for 24 hours, then writing only came along at about 11:07 p.m. That's how much of a latterly thing writing is. Now, of course, as history has gone by, it's been natural for there to be a certain amount of bleed between speech and writing. In a distant era now, it was common when one gave a speech to basically talk like writing. So, for example, the Gettysburg Address was not the main meal of that event. For 2 hours before that, Edward Everett spoke on a topic that frankly cannot engage us today and barely did then. The point of it was to listen to him speaking like writing. Ordinary people stood and listened to that for 2 hours. It was perfectly natural. That's what people did then, speaking like writing. Well, if you can speak like writing, then logically it follows that you might want to also sometimes write like you speak. The problem was just that in the material, mechanical sense, that was harder back in the day. It's almost impossible to do that with your hand, except in shorthand, and then communication is limited. On a manual typewriter, it was very difficult. And even when we had electric typewriters, or then computer keyboards, the fact is that even if you can type easily enough to keep up with the pace of speech, more or less, you have to have somebody who can receive your message quickly. Once you have things in your pocket that can receive that message, then you have the conditions that allow that we can write like we speak. And it's a very interesting thing, but nevertheless, easy to think that still it represents some sort of decline, that something has gone wrong. But the fact of the matter is that what is going on is a kind of emergent complexity.
Okay. Texting, is this like a serious thing for academics to be like the great linguists of the world? Are they saying, yeah, okay, let's sit down and like do a symposium on this thing because this is the real deal?
Yes.
Wow.
I mean, I'm not aware of a particular great symposium where people with three names and mutton chops are sitting down and talking about these things. But definitely it has become a thing, to use a current locution, to do papers on texting. I would say that anybody who teaches linguistics these days is expecting to see papers from students on texting. And it's because language changes generally slowly and below the radar. Whereas this, if I, in 1993, saw some of the text messages that we just traded at the beginning of this interview, I wouldn't have known what to make of it at all. I wouldn't have had anywhere to grab onto. And that's something that happens so very quickly. Linguists don't usually get to see language changing right now and this quickly. So yeah, it's a feast.
And so, for example, LOL. If you text now, or if you are someone who's aware of the substrate of texting the way it's become, you'll notice that LOL does not mean laughing out loud anymore. It's evolved into something that is much subtler. This is an actual text that was done by a non-male person of about 20 years old not too long ago. I love the font you're using.
I love the font you're using, BTW.
BTW. Julie, lol.
LOL, thanks. Gmail is being slow right now.
If you think about it, that's not funny. No one's laughing. And yet there it is. So you assume there's been some kind of hiccup. Then Susan says, lol, I know.
LOL, I know.
Again, more guffawing than we're used to when you're talking about these inconveniences. So Julie,
I just sent you an email.
Says, I just sent you an email. Susan, lol.
LOL, I see it.
Very funny people, if that's what LOL means. Julie says,
so what's up?
Susan, lol.
LOL, I had to write a 10-page paper.
I have to write a 10-page paper? She's not amused. Let's think about it. LOL is being used in a very particular way. It's a marker of empathy. It's a marker of accommodation. We linguists call things like that pragmatic particles. Any spoken language that's used by real people has them. If you happen to speak Japanese, think about that little word ne that you use at the end of a lot of sentences. If you listen to the way black youth today speak, think about the use of the word yo. Whole dissertations could be written about it and probably are being written about it. A pragmatic particle, that's what LOL has gradually become. It's a way of using the language between actual people.
And what's really important about a lot of these conventions is that they're actually quite sophisticated. To figure out what LOL actually means and the way that a linguist can figure out what even means in a sentence like he didn't even come. Imagine explaining to a foreigner what that even means. Mm. To do it in linguist style is every bit as challenging as figuring out an even or figuring out what like means in he was like tired. As slangy and sweat sock as that sounds to us, it really is a very subtle little item. But like took years and years and years and years and years to happen, whereas these are coming in an instant.
And here's the thing John McWhorter is noticing. The language we use in texting, it's looping back into our daily speech, as in OMG or slash to change a subject quickly, or when people say out loud, hashtag.
And so there are two possibilities. It could be that we're living in a time where it's considered cute to use things that you get from texting and from Twitter in speech as a gentle way to show how hip you are and to be part of the conversation. Or maybe we're seeing the beginning of a constant kind of interaction between texting conventions and speech that will never end. And so we've got this brand new layer of language that'll keep feeding in.
So it's interesting, right? Because we hear a lot about how, like, young people, they're texting and they're not really communicating and they're not going to develop communication skills. Do you think that's like there's something to that?
You know, having watched a fair number of people go through their teen years texting an awful lot, I can't say that I've seen evidence that texting a lot is going to interfere with people's ability to carry on a conversation, to enter into a relationship, etc. You might worry that it might, but I'm not sure that it does. I think that the social effect of texting that we most have to worry about is the fact that with the distance that's always there, even with the illusion of intimacy, it's easier to be mean. I think we're seeing a lot of this with the bullying episodes that sometimes even lead people to suicide. Texting, as well as equivalent sorts of communications on the screen through Facebook and GChat, make those sorts of things easier than they used to be when bullying was a matter of walking up to somebody and saying something to them. That's something that's worrisome.
Okay. How long before texting is a language taught at universities and, you know, fancy private schools?
You know something? I would make a prediction. I'm going to make a nervy prediction just for the heck of it.
All right, okay.
That within 2014, we will hear a report of texting lessons of some kind. Maybe for foreigners Or maybe there'll be some enterprising young 20-something or Zuckerbergian person who will present something like that as something 12-year-olds.
Burlesque for texters. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, texting for dummies, right. Certainly, 2014.
And there will be outrage.
Oh, yeah.
There will be media outrage.
How dare. It'll be like the Ebonics controversy. How dare you treat this as something respectable? But that will only make it more interesting to more people. I kind of wish I could write Texting for Dummies.
Maybe,
it would be a fun book to write.
Maybe you should do it.
You know, I'm going to ask those dummies people, wherever they are.
Okay, can I get a cut?
You will. You get 10% of the...
And so, the way I'm thinking of texting these days is that what we're seeing is a whole new way of writing that young people are developing, which they're using alongside their ordinary writing skills. And that means that they're able to do two things. Increasing evidence is that being bilingual is cognitively beneficial. That's also true of being bidialectal. That's certainly true of being bidialectal in terms of your writing. And so texting actually is evidence of a balancing act that young people are using today, not consciously, of course, but it's an expansion of their linguistic repertoire. So, in closing, if I could go into the future, if I could go into 2033, first thing I would ask is whether David Simon had done a sequel to The Wire. I would want to know. And I really would ask that. And then I'd want to know actually what was going on Downton Abbey. That'd be the second thing. And then the third thing would be, please show me a sheaf of texts written by 16-year-old girls, because I would want to know where this language had developed since our times. And ideally, I would then send them back to you and me now so we could examine this linguistic miracle happening right under our noses. Thank you very much.
That's linguist John McWhorter. His talk, TXTING, is Killing Language JK, is at ted.npr.org.
LOL. I hope I wasn't too lame.
Lame.
LOL. ROFL. FWIW. You got the 411 on this, man.
More spoken and unspoken in a moment. I'm Guy Raz, and this is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And our show today, spoken and unspoken, how we communicate. Now, here's the thing about language. It's this amazing tool because it is a tool that has only evolved in our species, in Homo sapiens. We are the only ones ever to develop language. Why is it that language only evolved in our species?
It's a complicated argument, but it really boils down to the fact that other animals don't really have anything to talk about.
This is Mark Pagel. He's an evolutionary biologist.
Now, we're a species that allows individuals to specialize at what they're good at and then trade what they make or produce with other people for objects that they make or produce. No other animal does that. As soon as that capability arises, you need to have a technology, a piece of social technology, for arranging deals. And that conduit is language. But why we and we alone came to that sort of tipping point of cognition, I think is still something of a mystery.
And it's possible that that tipping point actually happened sometime around 200,000 years ago. And then something really strange happened.
As we spread out around the world, we developed thousands of different languages. Currently, there are about 7,000 or 8,000 different languages spoken on Earth. But the real puzzle and irony is that the greatest density of different languages on Earth is found where people are most tightly packed together. If we go to the island of Papua New Guinea, we can find about 800 to 1,000 different human languages spoken on that island alone. There are places on that island where you can encounter a new language every 2 or 3 miles. And so it seems that we use our language not just to cooperate, but to draw rings around our cooperative groups and to establish identities, and perhaps to protect our knowledge and wisdom and skills from eavesdropping from outside. Different languages slow the flow of ideas between groups. They slow the flow of technologies. And they even slow the flow of genes.
When you think about humans, right, and the way we evolved, we evolved in a way that would not allow us to communicate with other members of our species, which seems so weird.
It is really peculiar on the face of it that our languages exist to prevent us from communicating with each other. And of course, that's the subtext of the Tower of Babel. And it's as if we use our language almost instinctively and subconsciously as a marker of tribal identity. As soon as someone opens their mouth and we hear their accent, we start to place them. And what we're subconsciously doing is saying, are they one of us? You know, are they within our in-group? Are they an out-group member? And one of the reasons I think we can do that is that it is exceedingly difficult to learn a language to a very high standard, such that you can pass yourself off. You know, your accent or the words that you use or the idioms that you use will give you away. And so I think one of the reasons we've evolved to use it that way is because it is in some sense a reliable signal of our sort of tribal background.
It's interesting because it would sort of confirm this idea that humans are tribal instinctively, that they're not cooperative.
The wonderful sort of paradox and the sort of uncomfortable nature of our tribalism is that we are really remarkably and uniquely cooperative among animals within our tribal groups. And that, you know, the simplest examples of this on a sort of daily basis are the holding doors for people and giving up seats on trains. But, you know, we give to charities and we volunteer to fight in wars and so on. And yet that cooperation that we engage in, at least throughout our history, has largely been confined to other members of our tribe. And as soon as we move outside the tribe, it's as if a lot of our ethical and moral stances evaporate, and we can treat people outside of our tribe as kind of subhuman.
Okay, this tendency we have towards isolation, towards keeping to ourselves, crashes headfirst into our modern world. Our modern world is communicating with itself and with each other more than it has at any time in its past. And that globalization now raises a burden because these different languages impose a barrier to cooperation. Put it this way, nature knows no other circumstance in which functionally equivalent traits coexist. One of them always drives the other extinct. And we see this in the inexorable march towards standardization. There are lots and lots of ways of measuring things, but the metric system is winning. There are lots and lots of ways of measuring time, but a really bizarre base 60 system known as hours and minutes and seconds is nearly universal around the world. And so our modern world now is confronting us with a dilemma, and it's the dilemma that this Chinese man faces, whose language is spoken by more people in the world than any other single language. And yet he is sitting at his blackboard converting Chinese phrases into English language phrases.
So you can imagine a future in which, you know, people will still speak Mandarin or Hindi, but everybody will also speak English.
You know, it's interesting that if we look around the world, there are about 7,000 to 8,000 distinct languages, but about 10 languages account for about 50% of all speakers on Earth. And what's happening is that something like 30 to 50 languages per year go extinct. So we're losing our linguistic diversity at a really alarming rate. It's virtually inevitable that there will be a single language on Earth.
Really?
Yes, and the reason is that we can already see it happening, that something on the order of 2 billion people speak English as their second language. And what will happen is that if when you imagine two large language communities living next door to each other, one of those languages is continually sort of out-competing the other. So at every exchange in a local shop, someone's got to agree to speak the other language. Simply because English has such an enormous head start, one would have to bet on English being the language that's going to be the sort of, you know, and this is a terrible sort of metaphor, the lingua franca for the world.
But I mean, if that happened, I mean, it would also change English.
Yes, one of the remarkable things is how English is fissioning into many forms of English. So there's Spanglish and there's Franglish. But the remarkable thing around the world is that all of these sort of dialects of English are very good at communicating with each other. We expect if there are these forces of homogenation, they will lead eventually to a single kind of gray form of English that's spoken all over the world. And of course, there'll be sort of regional dialects, but we expect they would all be sort of intercommunicable. People will be able to speak to each other, as they already are.
And then what this does is it raises the possibility to us that in a world in which we want to promote cooperation and exchange, in a world that might be dependent more than ever before on cooperation to maintain and enhance our levels of prosperity, it might be inevitable that we have to confront the idea that our destiny is to be one world with one language. Thank you.
Mark Pagel, he's a professor of evolutionary biology at the University of Reading. His talk, How Language Transformed Humanity, is at ted.npr.org.
My name is Phuc Tran. I live in Portland, Maine. I teach Latin and Greek.
You don't look like a Latin and Greek teacher. You look like a hipster, like you should be wearing a leather apron, like you should be making homemade tonics and bitters. Do you do that too?
No, I don't. I
mean, okay, maybe not a mixologist, but Phuc is also a tattoo artist, and he's actually tattooed himself.
When I got the tattoo fever, I just was like, I want to be covered in tattoos. And one day I just was like, I want to do this huge thing on my thigh.
What is it?
Oh, it's like a big koi, you know, like a fish. And, you know, I look at it and I'm like, man, that thing stinks.
Now, tattooer's regret actually does have something to do with Phuc's other passion, which is grammar. Because thinking that you could or should have done something different, it's all possible because of the subjunctive mood, which is what Phuc's talk is all about.
I'm here to talk about how grammar is a tool to be used like a pair of glasses. And when it's used at the right time, it can bring the world into sharp focus. And when it's used at the wrong time, it can make things incredibly blurry. And this all starts with our understanding of the subjunctive. I remember talking to my dad about this, and because he's a non-native speaker of English, he didn't quite grasp all the nuances of the subjunctive. I'd say, Dad, listen, you can say, if it hadn't rained, we would have gone to the beach. And my dad's response, that's stupid. Why do you want to talk about something that didn't happen? Fair enough. The subjunctive allows us to look into the future and to see multiple highly nuanced possibilities with just a little sprinkling of coulds, woulds, or mights. Similarly, it allows us to look into the past and to imagine what didn't happen but could have happened. The subjunctive is the most powerful mood. It's like a time-space dream machine that can conjure alternate realities with just the idea of could have or should have. But within this idea of should have is a Pandora's box of hope and regret. Growing up in Pennsylvania as a Vietnamese refugee, I often thought about what would have happened if my family hadn't escaped Saigon in 1975. Would we have been imprisoned like my father's cousin who spent years in re-education camp being tortured and sentenced to hard labor? Or would we have simply been killed like countless other South Vietnamese who were unable to escape that April? The night that my family was fleeing Saigon, my entire family, parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles, we were all scheduled to board a bus. And as that bus was loading passengers, I began crying, shrieking uncontrollably, so much so that my entire family decided to wait for the next bus. And as that bus pulled away from us, it was struck by artillery fire. It exploded, and everyone on board was killed. As a kid, I thought a lot about our good fortune in escaping and about what would have happened if we hadn't. And I didn't realize it at the time, but I was pondering things that my parents couldn't ponder, and it was all because of the English subjunctive.
You don't think your family ever thought about what could have been?
I really don't. And, you know, after I thought about that, I was visiting my mom because she was sick, and one of my aunts was there visiting her as well, you know, just for conversation. My aunt recounted the whole story again, you know, all the details were pretty much there. And I remember asking her, you know, what do you... in English, you know, what do you think, you know, would have happened? And she she was like, I don't know. I guess we would have all died. You could kind of tell, like, she hadn't really, like, she was just like, why would you even want to think about that? Or what's the point? It's like kind of like this pointless exercise in pondering what could have happened. That's like a huge piece, Guy, in that pondering the could have, would have, and should have, right? Like, does it benefit you to think about the things that could have happened, you know, or does it just kind of fester? And if it does, and if it's not good for you and good for your sort of your soul, you know, let it go, because I think it's not healthy, right? But I think it's obviously easier said than done.
For my father, there were no alternate realities in 1975. There was just what happened and what didn't happen. Even if he did feel the pangs of losing a life that he should have had, he didn't have the language to express it. In Vietnam, my father was a lawyer and an aspiring politician. He should have had a career. He should have been somebody important. Yet there he was in 1975 in a country he didn't know, driving a cement mixer, trying to learn English and support his family. For my parents' survival, however, this lack of the subjunctive was fundamental to their resiliency. They were able to provide for me and my brother to do what needed to be done, in part because they didn't expend psychic energy on what could have been. In Vietnamese, there was just the naked indicativeness of the world, and they met it head on. As a kid growing up, for me, the subjunctive of English was this mirage of an oasis. Through the power of the subjunctive, I imagined this amazing world, this fantastical world, where my name wasn't weird. I was trying to pretend that I was this typical American teenager. I played in a punk band, I skateboarded, I worked at a gas station, I ran away from home, I got into fights, I smoked pot. It was kind of like this Asian kid had been photoshopped into a John Hughes movie. I didn't look like any of my friends, and my family, full of brown immigrants and exotic smells, didn't look like my friends' families. And as a result, I didn't know what should have happened and what my future should have looked like as I spun my wheels in the quagmire of the subjunctive, wishing that I were someone else or somewhere else. What I did know was that when I graduated from high school, I wanted to double major in art and English. Then the unexpected happened. I hated my English and art classes. By the end of that semester, I had dropped both majors and I was undeclared. I was utterly depressed and deflated because I hated what I thought I should have loved. Dejected, I sat down with my dad that December to tell him that I didn't want to major in art and English anymore, as I awaited some reprimand from him. But my father was completely calm, without a hint of disappointment. There was no "you should" speech from him, because that would have required a command of the subjunctive, which he lacks. Instead, this is what he said. "You don't want to major in art and English anymore? That's fine. Don't study what you don't like. What do you like? Study that." That was it. His answer was so simple. It was like pure, unfiltered reality delivered with the indicative. And so that's what I did. I went back to school, to college, and that spring I signed up on a whim for ancient Greek. And it was brutally hard, and I loved every minute of it. I loved every clause, every accent, every participle. I wasn't restrained by ideas of what I was supposed to study or should have been studying. I simply pursued what I honestly loved, embracing the reality, the indicativeness of my passions. Should have didn't improve my present or my future. Should have simply blinded me to what was, because I was so fixated on what wasn't.
I mean, the subjunctive is, I guess, in a sense, it's all about regret.
Or possibility, right? So if it's backwards looking, yes, the subjunctive certainly can eat somebody alive and fill them full of regret. But the subjunctive looking forward, I think, is amazing. You have people who move things forward because they're able to think about things that don't exist, like the civil rights movement and, you know, women's suffrage, like all that stuff, you know, sort of these huge, you know, seismic cultural pushes forward. It does have a dark side, but it also propels a lot of progress forward.
We take off and put on the lenses of the subjunctive and the indicative every day. And once we recognize the pitfalls of both the indicative and the subjunctive, we can actively choose a more positive and optimistic outlook. Go and reclaim and reappropriate your language and grammar. It's your first and most powerful tool to experiencing and communicating the world around you. We all use the indicative and the subjunctive every day, and we can be mindful of when we are blinded by the subjunctive and when we are overlooking the indicative around us. Thank you.
Phuc Tran. His talk is called The Dark Side of the Subjunctive. Check it out at ted.npr.org. Stay with us. More spoken and unspoken, how we communicate, in just a moment. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz, and our show today is all about language, spoken and unspoken, what we say, how we say it, right down to the anatomy of a word, one single word, and that word is...
President.
Mr. Speaker.
Absolutely, that's the big one.
The President of the United States.
The most powerful man on earth.
This is Mark Forsyth. He studies and writes about words.
You look back at the history of language and how words change so much. I mean, I wrote a whole book, The Etymologicon, all about this. Words can't control the world. The world controls words.
Now, in his TED Talk, Mark tells the story of that word, president, and the battle to control what it meant.
I want to take you back to the United States of America just after they'd achieved independence. And they had to face the question of what to call George Washington, their leader. They didn't know. What do you call the leader of a Republican country? And this was debated in Congress for ages and ages. And there were all sorts of suggestions on the table which might have made it. I mean, some people wanted him to be called Chief Magistrate Washington, and other people His Highness George Washington, and other people Protector of the Liberties of the People of the United States of America. Some people just wanted to call him King. They thought it was tried and tested, and they weren't even being monarchical there. They had the idea that you could be elected king for a fixed term. And, you know, could have worked. And everybody got insanely bored, actually, because this debate went on for 3 weeks, and I read a diary of this poor senator who just keeps coming back, still on this subject. And the reason for the delay and the boredom was that the House of Representatives were against the Senate. The House of Representatives didn't want Washington to get drunk on power. They didn't want to call him king in case that gave him ideas or his successor ideas. So they wanted to give him the humblest, meagerest, most pathetic title they could think of. And that title was president. President. They didn't invent the title. I mean, it existed before, but it just meant somebody who presides over a meeting. It was like the foreman of the jury, and it didn't have much more grandeur than the term foreman or overseer. There were occasional presidents of little colonial councils and bits of government, but it was really a nothing title. And that's why the Senate objected to it. They said, that's ridiculous, you can't call him president. This guy has to go and sign treaties and meet foreign dignitaries. And who's going to take him seriously if he's got a silly little title like President of the United States of America?
So it's amazing that the idea that the word was almost like designed to humiliate George Washington.
It was. There was actually somebody said in the Senate, they said that this is ridiculous. You have the president of a cricket club or a fire company. I mean, cricket was actually played back in America back in those days. You cannot call the head of state president. But whatever title they'd given him, it would have acquired that glory. You know, in the end, they could have called him Bunny Rabbit Washington. And now Bunny Rabbit would have, you know, would sound really, really big and frightening.
Bunny Rabbit, yeah. on the planet.
Yeah, I mean, if the Bunny Rabbit has a fleet of drones, you respect the Bunny Rabbit.
And after 3 weeks of debate, in the end, the Senate did not cave in. Instead, they agreed to use the title president for now. But they also wanted it absolutely set down that they didn't agree with it. Now, you can learn three interesting things from this. First of all, and this is my favorite, is that so far as I've ever been able to find out, the Senate has never formally endorsed the title of president. Second thing you can learn is that when a government says that this is a temporary measure, you can still be waiting 223 years later. But the third thing you can learn, and this is the really important one, this is the point I want to leave you on, is that the title, President of the United States of America, doesn't sound that humble at all these days, does it? Reality and history have endowed that title with grandeur. And so the Senate won in the end. They got their title of respectability. Now, do you know how many nations have a president? 147. All because they want to sound like the guy who's got the 5,000 nuclear warheads, etc. And that's the important lesson I think you can take away and the one I want to leave you with. Politicians try to pick words and use words to shape reality and control reality. But in fact, reality changes words far more than words can ever change reality.
I mean, every policy that comes out is going to be called, you know, the environment or the clean air bill. It's never going to be called the high taxes bill or something like that. And all these things, I mean, words can change reality a bit until people notice that the thing with this name is really, really unpleasant or really, really pleasant, whatever it happens to be. If somebody says to you, would you like a kitten? And you say, oh, a kitten. And yes, please. And they just punch you in the face and say, would you like another kitten? You're going to say no.
Okay, so do you think that we shape our language or does it shape us?
I think we shape language more than it shapes us. And reality, history shapes language. And that's the beautiful thing, that it's lovely when you trace the history of words, because you suddenly you stop and say, what, it meant that back then. And it changes the way you see the word and the way the world has changed that word.
Mark Forsyth. His latest book is called The Horologicon, a day's jaunt through the lost words of the English language. You can hear his entire talk at TED.com. So up until this point, the kind of communication we've been hearing about is language, right? Words we speak or write or text, basically things we have near complete control over. But the thing is, you don't have complete control over how you communicate, because a big part of it happens unconsciously. Which brings us to Harvard psychologist and professor Amy Cuddy, who teaches at the business school.
At least half of communication is through nonverbal signals, and that includes vocal cues, like your pitch and how quickly you're speaking and how much range you show. So the language, I think, is at least smaller than most of us believe it is.
Amy Cuddy studies nonverbal communication, the way you stand, how you move your hands, or the way you furrow your eyebrows, things we do that send signals to other people about what we're like in that very moment. But she also studies how those same signals affect the way we think about ourselves. Take a listen to Amy Cuddy on the TED stage.
So when we think of nonverbals, we think of how we judge others, how they judge us, and what the outcomes are. We tend to forget, though, the other audience that's influenced by our nonverbals, and that's ourselves. We are also influenced by our nonverbals, our thoughts and our feelings and our physiology. So what nonverbals am I talking about? I'm a social psychologist, I study prejudice, and I teach at a competitive business school. So it was inevitable that I would become interested in power dynamics. I became especially interested in nonverbal expressions of power and dominance.
So a few years ago, Amy got frustrated by something that tends to happen at super competitive places like Harvard Business School. And it's that male students tend to dominate classroom discussions, and women are more likely to stay quiet. And Amy wanted to see if she could smash up that power dynamic.
This is what we did. We decided to bring people into the lab and run a little experiment. And these people adopted for 2 minutes either high power poses or low power poses.
Power poses. And a lot of the science on this comes from the animal world. So, you know, animals that are scared, they're
trying to stay hidden from predators, they crunch up and they get small, and then when they want to stand their ground, they go big.
Through postures that are open, that are expansive, and that occupy space.
So, for instance,
it's the Wonder Woman pose and it's the Superman pose.
Wide stance, chest out, hands on hips.
That's one of them. Another one is sitting, putting your feet up on your desk, and leaning back, putting your hands behind your head with your elbows out.
Huh. Okay, I got you. Yeah.
We call that the CEO pose. So try the CEO pose.
Yeah, that's good.
So you're sitting, but you're still spread out. You know, you're still making yourself big.
Yeah.
A third one is what my collaborator Dana Carney calls the starfish pose. And that's, you know, it's basically the victory pose. So you have your arms up in a V, but you also have your feet spread apart.
Do it. Let's do it. Let's do it right now. Stand up. I'm going to stand up, okay? I'm just a little bit off mic. I'm doing the Wonder Woman right now. Okay, we're going to do it. Let's
I'm
do
gonna
it.
Do the starfish.
All right, okay.
All right.
That's good.
Feeling better.
That's great. I mean, this is crazy. It looks totally ridiculous, but somehow there's like a message coming to my brain saying, go out and conquer the world.
Right. There's a message going to your brain telling you, your body is telling you that you're powerful.
Do we know, like, what happens inside of you, like, physiologically when you do that? Is there actually a process that takes place that makes you feel that way?
What we looked at, Dana Carney, Andy Yap, and I, those are my two main collaborators in this work, we decided to look at hormones because there are hormones that we know are linked to feeling powerful or being in a position of leadership. And those two hormones are testosterone. And the other one is cortisol. So it turns out people who are powerful and animals that are powerful tend to have relatively high testosterone and relatively low cortisol. And that's true for men and women. And so we decided to look at whether or not power posing could actually change those hormones. So we put people in these power poses for 2 minutes or in low power poses. And we take a saliva sample, and what we find is that after 2 minutes, they are experiencing very, very big changes in those hormone levels. So in other words, for 2 minutes, standing like Wonder Woman in a tiny room can basically lead you to physiologically, in some ways, look like someone who has an enormous amount of power.
Wow. Just by standing there, like with your hands on your hips.
Exactly. So think about this in contrast to, so think about Stuart Smalley.
Oh, yes.
And I know that this is not real.
He's now a U.S. senator.
I know.
Yes.
I know he is.
Yes, Al Franken.
But okay, so what did he say? I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me.
Yes.
You know, so that's what people think of when they think of self-affirmation or self-affirming tools. They think about
a mantra or something.
Right. Here's the problem with that. If you don't believe it already, that's why you're in that situation, right? So that's the beauty and the elegance of this as an intervention. Instead of verbally telling yourself that you actually are fantastic, you stand, you know, with your arms in a V and your body tells yourself you're great.
When I tell people about this, that our bodies change our minds and our minds can change our behavior and our behavior can change our outcomes, they say to me, it feels fake, right? So I said, fake it till you make it. Like, it's not me. I don't want to get there only to feel like I'm not supposed to be here. And that really resonated with me because I want to tell you a little story about being an imposter and feeling like I'm not supposed to be here. When I was 19, I was in a really bad car accident. I was thrown out of a car, rolled several times. I was thrown from the car, and I woke up in a head injury rehab ward. And I had been withdrawn from college, and I learned that my IQ had dropped by 2 standard deviations, which was very traumatic. I knew my IQ because I had identified with being smart, and I had been called gifted as a child. So I'm taken out of college. I keep trying to go back. They say, you're not going to finish college. Like, just, you know, there are other things for you to do, but that's not going to work out for you. So I really struggled with this. And I have to say, having your identity taken from you, your core identity, and for me it was being smart, Having that taken from you, there's nothing that leaves you feeling more powerless than that. So I felt entirely powerless. I worked and worked and worked, and I got lucky and worked and got lucky and worked. Eventually, I graduated from college. It took me 4 years longer than my peers, and I convinced someone, my angel advisor, Susan Fiske, to take me on, and so I ended up at Princeton, and I was like, I am not supposed to be here. I am an imposter. And the night before my first year talk, and the first year talk at Princeton is a 20-minute talk to 20 people. That's it. I was so afraid of being found out the next day that I called her and said, I'm quitting. She was like, you are not quitting, because I took a gamble on you and you're staying. You're gonna stay, and this is what you're gonna do. You are gonna fake it. You're just gonna do it and do it and do it, even if you're terrified and just paralyzed and having an out-of-body experience until you have this moment where you say, oh my gosh, I'm doing it. Like, I have become this. I am actually doing this. So that's what I did, 5 years in grad school. A few years, you know, I'm at Northwestern, I moved to Harvard. I'm at Harvard, I'm not really thinking about it anymore, but for a long time I had been thinking, not supposed to be here, not supposed to be here. So the end of my first year at Harvard, a student who had not talked in class the entire semester, who I had said, look, you gotta participate or else you're gonna fail, came into my office. I really didn't know her at all. And she said, she came in totally defeated, and she said, I'm not supposed to be here. And that was the moment for me, because two things happened. One was that I realized, oh my gosh, I don't feel like that anymore, you know? I don't feel that anymore, but she does, and I get that feeling. And the second was, she is supposed to be here. Like, she can fake it, she can become it. So I was like, yes, you are. You are supposed to be here, and tomorrow you're gonna fake it, you're gonna make yourself powerful, and, you know, you're gonna, and you're gonna go into the classroom and you are gonna give the best comment ever, you know? And she gave the best comment ever. And people turned around, they were like, oh my God, I didn't even notice her sitting there, you know? Tiny tweaks can lead to big changes. So this is 2 minutes. 2 minutes, 2 minutes, 2 minutes. Before you go into the next stressful evaluative situation, configure your brain to cope the best in that situation. Get your testosterone up, get your cortisol down. And also, I want to ask you to share the science, because the people who can use it the most are the ones with no resources and no status and no power. Give it to them, because they can do it in private. They need their bodies, privacy, and 2 minutes, and it can significantly change the outcomes of their life. Thank you.
Amy Cuddy's TED Talk has been seen by nearly 8 million people. She gets hundreds of letters each week from people who say those two simple minutes have really changed their lives.
That's right.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show this week, Spoken and Unspoken. If you missed any of it, if you want to hear more, or if you want to find out more about who was on it, check out ted.npr.org. You can also find many, many more TED Talks at ted.com, and you can download this show through iTunes or through the NPR smartphone app. Our program was produced by Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Neva Grant, and Sanaz Meshkinpour, with help from Portia Robertson-Migas and Eric Newsom. Thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading here on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.